Hi, welcome back to the Pleasure Project. So in this episode, I interview Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers. She's a PhD, LMFT, she's a sex therapist, and she is brilliant. And we really talk about shame because that is at the core of so much sexual dysfunction. And we talk about the roots of shame and how it, you know, kind of infiltrates relationships. We also talk a little bit about family of origin and how that factors in. We talk about psychedelics a little bit. So tune in. It's a great episode. She's, you know, it was really just kind of a wandering, meandering conversation between two sex therapists, and it's a great listen. Thanks.
All right. So welcome back. I've got a wonderful guest today, Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers. She's a PhD, LMFT, and CSTS. So Dr. Tina is a nationally known speaker, educator, and writer on sexual health and the biopsychosexual impact of sexual shame and trauma. She's a professor emerita of sexuality, marriage, and family therapy at Seattle Pacific University. As a past board member for the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, Dr. Sellers is at the forefront shaping change in the lives of professionals and families. As a preeminent voice of the impact of abstinence education, purity culture, and the failure to provide comprehensive sex education, Dr. Sellers has been featured in Spirituality and Health, Refinery 29, Medium, several magazines, actually really good ones, as well as NPR's All Things Considered. In her 2017 book, Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy, Dr. Sellers revealed how the Western Conservative Church has infiltrated our core ability to attach to our partners and instruct our children to attach to theirs. Tina's most recent book, Shameless Parenting, Everything You Need to Raise Shame-Free, Confident Kids and Heal Your Shame Too, was a new release bestseller. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Jen. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, you've had a lot going on. Yeah. And I was intrigued by the shame component of your work, because I just think that is such a core issue that I see over and over again in both the sex addiction population and just those that are coming in for sex therapy. So I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here and glad to talk about that, because I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. So tell us, like, let's just launch a little bit with what, you know, your history. How did you get to this juncture and this focus in your work?
Yeah, thanks. So I taught in a marriage and family therapy accredited program for 28 years. Early on in my career, I taught marriage and family therapy. I taught medical family therapy, but I also taught sex therapy. I taught the course that was required for licensure for therapists in the state of Washington there in our program. And one of the things I had our students do was write their sexual autobiography as part of their assignments in the class. Now, most people hear that and they think, oh my gosh, I can't imagine ever committing that story to paper. But I would say to them, you know, you've learned this in the program, and I'm just punctuating it here. You're only ever as good a therapist as you know what your own stories are. You know where you begin and end, and you are aware of the work that you still need to do to grow and heal. So I'm going to have you do this because if of all the stories that you guys are going to write in your program, this is going to be the one that doesn't have a very good arc, a very good narrative. It's got these memories like, oh, I remember getting in trouble at 5, or I remember my first kiss or whatever, but it's not a good cohesive narrative. So sitting and writing it, I'm going to give you like 70 questions, is going to help you create a narrative that you can then look at and ask, what's the legacy I'm bringing forward? And is this the legacy I want? Or is there something else that I want here as far as healing goes? And so it was one of the last classes that they took in their program. They were grateful for that. And I read, I don't know, 600 of these over the years. Right around the year 2000, I noticed this dramatic increase in what I later called sexual shame. this sense of just describing themselves like they were disgusted with themselves. They were humiliated by themselves, by what they thought, felt, and done over the arc of their story. And so it also punctuated how much they didn't know about what was normative curiosity, normative desire, normative, right? In the scheme of what we hear about all the time as sex therapists. And I thought, what's happening that this dramatic shift is happening in the tone of these papers? And it really bothered me. I can remember crying and going into my chair's office and saying, something's happening. I don't know what, but something's happening. And I have students that are describing themselves in such hateful terms and with so much condemnation, right? Blame, that it's almost as if they were sexually abused. And then they're showing up with or describing sexual dysfunction issues that I've not before seen in 20 and 30 year olds. And I was at the time also teaching in the family medicine department at the University of Washington as well, and talking to docs and about their cases and whatnot. So I'm like, something's going on because things are showing up that wasn't showing up before. So I just really kind of did a deep dive, started talking more to students and more to clients about what was going on. And it took me a few years. Finally, what I kind of put together was I was seeing the first wave of people that hit their adolescence in the mid 90s. Or a little earlier, anywhere from 92 forward and hitting their adolescence then, when we started pumping billions of dollars into abstinence-only education, which we later did research on. It was 80% medically inaccurate, and it was primarily religious education, but we were now funding it through the federal government, as well as I was having students that in their youth groups who were going to church or whatever, and in their youth groups were having experiences like sitting around and their youth person talking about how horrible being sexual was, to think about it, to desire it, to do it, while they were doing things like passing around pieces of pizza and asking everybody to take a bite, passing around a flower, asking everybody to take a petal, passing around a lollipop, telling everybody to take a bite, gluing together two contrasting pieces of paper, and then at the end of the talk, asking them to take them apart, holding up the stick, the petal, the stem or whatever, and saying, this is all you'll have to give to your future partner. You won't be valuable. Basically, you're going to be unlovable to God, right? And it wasn't, again, don't have sex before marriage. That was in there. But it was don't think about, don't desire it, don't do anything related to it, including self-pleasure, or you will ruin your future and ruin your relationship with God. So all this fear-mongering started in the 80s, and it really started catching on in the early 90s. And it was socio-political. It was the religious right and the moral majority getting into the politics, as well as what was happening in the evangelical churches. They took a hard right. And we ended up with students that were displaying symptoms of having the same symptoms of somebody who had been sexually abused, because their developing sexuality had been basically hurt along the way.
That's interesting, right? It's like, and it's also kind of correlates with the AIDS epidemic and coming out of that.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, I was born in 73, so I was, you know, graduating high school in 91. So I was sort of in that. And the sort of undertone of fear, I remember fear of pregnancy first, but also certainly fear of AIDS. You know, that was, you know, part of the narrative. But also I was raised in a religious community where that message was definitely there too, about sex being bad, dangerous. Yeah. And so that is a really quiet, but well, sometimes it can be loud, but it's a quiet thing that can kind of stay in your unconscious forever.
Absolutely.
Right. And so flash forward, they're 40, 50s now, and they're having a whole lot of difficulty with sex.
They are.
Because that message still feels true.
Well, and I think we have to also look at the other messages that they were getting. So you're right. There was a lot of fear. There was fear from second wave feminism. There was fear from AIDS. We also had an economic downturn that happened during the early 80s. You can see, if you take a 40,000 foot view and you look at cultures, that when the populace is afraid, that they are much more apt to be captured by those in political power. And so we had this really ripe thing that was happening, but we have to look at what was also happening.
It feels like, I'm sorry, it feels like deja vu right now.
Really? Yeah.
I mean, this is a little bit of what's in the ether now.
Well, it's actually a continuation. Last night I watched a documentary called, what is it called? God and Democracy. And it charts the whole thing. So if this is a continuation, it's just been growing for a really long time. But what was happening also was things like, it was really a push in capitalism that was hidden behind family values. So we removed the regulations on the FCC, the media, in about 85. We removed regulations that had been in banks to protect the public much around that same exact time. Then we started to have music videos, video games, right? Then eventually we had the online, and we had online pornography growing, right? We had different things. And there was an increase in violence against women that was happening in all of those venues, right? And then social media, right? Then that became our default educator on sexuality to the public. So the public was getting, you know, we hyped up masculinity and toxic masculinity in those years and still do. I mean, if you look at how Superman has changed since the 50s, you'll see it, just the images. But so we hyped up this toxic masculinity, which was, I need to know, I've got to be in charge, you know, whatever, I've got to be hypersexual, you know, a lot of this stuff. And women were also being sort of, well, you need to be like the sex kitten, and you know, but then you got to be pure at the same time, you know, all of these.
Right. Walking that line that's impossible.
Right. They hyped up. And so what you have now, and I think we especially see this with our straight couples, is this lack of communication, lack of understanding about each other, lack of understanding of themselves, a proscribed type of sexuality that is very transactional and obligatory. So no one's really getting what they want. He's not getting her heart, her presence often, you know, they're performative, right?
Yeah.
And they're both lonely, and they're doing things that they don't want to do, right? They're just not being really honest and having vulnerable exchanges.
Yeah. Well, and to that end, I see these couples oftentimes where the straight couples where the women are kind of hitting that 50-year-old period, and they're like, I'm not doing it anymore.
Absolutely.
It's not that they actually don't like sex, though. It's that they don't like the sex they've been having.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And they hit
right.
this empty nesting period, and they're just like, I'm done. I'm
out.
Behaving anymore. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I'm out of sex anyway. And so it's this,
right.
You know, but bringing them back, like looking at the messages of shame, because it comes in, you know, through different doors. I mean, certainly I've worked with lots of folks that had a religious upbringing and that were really told to wait for marriage. And so there's all this buildup, and then they get married kind of quickly because they want to have access to sexuality. And then it doesn't go very well. And it's not what they had thought it was going to be. And they can't sometimes shake that message, the purity message, right? Right. They've had so much reinforcement about staying away from it that they can't really ever claim it.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Not only they can't claim it, but they don't know what they want or if pleasure is even okay, right? And then they don't know how to talk about it. And they think that they do a lot of shoulds. I should do this and I should do that, right? And none of that really creates a co-created connection and pleasure experience that they both actually really want. And they just don't even know how to begin to get there. And that's really what so many sex therapists will work on, is helping them go from what they got and didn't get with regard to sexuality education, right? And what's true and wonderful and magnificent about their bodies. And then really healing the shame that sticks like glue. I often think of it like those pictures of birds in oil spills, you know, it just sticks to you, and it's hard to come off. And it's really, I often will say, the reason that it is so sticky is for many people, they started getting this message as soon as they found their genitals at a year old, and somebody was mm-hmm. there, and they didn't understand why they were getting in trouble. And it didn't just happen once, it happened hundreds of times, because it's not until they're about three or four that they actually can begin to go, oh, I'm getting in trouble for these things, you know? And they start to hold
don't touch
better.
Don't touch. Don't. All the
exactly like five, they play with their cousins or whatever, you know, and they get in trouble for their curiosity. They remember that story. We hear that story a lot. What's the first one? Well, I think I was, but this one, none of this happened. Well, we know that those previous 4 years, if they were at all curious, they are prone. We are born prone for connection and pleasure, desiring connection and pleasure. Right. And so kids are going to rub the inside of their bunny's ear on their cheek because it feels good. And they're going to touch their genitals because it feels good. It's comforting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they just,
how do you see the relationship to like body image and shame?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it might be helpful right here to share with you and your listeners the operational definition of sexual shame. We didn't actually have research on it until 2017. So it was after my book came out. But the definition is so poignant that I think it sets the stage for answering that question, the role that culture plays in our body image, right? As well as, so we've got this beginning part of getting in trouble around our bodies. And then we get to be six or by six, and we've started to figure out from commercials that we're not good enough the way we are. So culture then secondarily reinforces it. And the definition talks about this. The definition says sexual shame is a visceral feeling. So it's not just cognitive. It's in our bodies. It's a visceral in ourselves. It's a somatic feeling in our bodies of humiliation and disgust toward one's own body and identity as a sexual being, and a belief of being abnormal, inferior, and unworthy. Okay. The people in this study were not religious. Maybe there was one of the participants. So this has not come from people of religious population. This feeling can be internalized. So like, you know, it goes inside. But it also manifests in interpersonal relationships. So that's really where it begins, between infant or toddler and other, right? Having a negative impact on trust, communication, and physical and emotional intimacy. So it hits every core area of the intimate attached relationship. It goes on to say sexual shame develops across the lifespan in interactions with interpersonal relationships. One's culture and society picks up, right? Round six, we have 50% of six-year-olds modifying their diets already, right? So we already know they're getting it. And then it creates a subsequent critical self-appraisal. So a continuous feedback loop, an internal critic that just then tortures us really for the
rest. Looks for more evidence that separates self. All that chatter going on in the head is like, good luck trying to connect with another person with unabashed,
abandon. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. The last thing it says is there is also a fear and uncertainty related to one's power or right to make decisions, including safety decisions related to sexual encounters, along with an internalized judgment toward one's own sexual desire. I think about Peggy Ornstein's work when I think about this part of the definition, because she interviewed 80 girls, 15 to 22. Then she did her boy book. And with these girls, she said, you know, they described feeling competent in every area of their life until they got ready to go out. And then they were putting down 3, 4, 5 shots of hard liquor because they didn't know if they could keep themselves safe or if they had the right to. Right. Mm-hmm. And boom, it's right there in the definition. So culture just overlays the minute we're just starting to figure out that we run our economy based on you not feeling good enough about yourself. So you'll go spend money. That's how we run our economy. And so it is coming at us everywhere. And it's just layering on what however home responded and however media is giving us, and then we're not giving them the tools they need, the sex, comprehensive sex education, life education, relationship education, to equip them to go, oh, that's not right. Oh, that's fantasy. Oh, that's, we're not giving them that. So they're not equipped and they're very susceptible to being exploited or exploiting.
Right.
Yeah.
And the boys are not, protected from this, right? They're getting different messages that are also super negative.
Yeah.
And they've got all kinds of self-doubt in,
yes,
you know, and disconnection. It's affecting both.
Yeah.
So tell us about sort of your model for approaching this. Like, what is your solution?
So when I talk about, in the book, I talk about how did America become sex negative? You know, what actually happened historically that set this up? What role does our consumer-based culture play in that? You know, and was there ever positive messages, like ancient messages? And there were some beautiful ones on the Abrahamic line, because a lot of people can't go to the Eastern side, like it feels too uncomfortable. So I'm like, there's a whole mess of stuff here that just wasn't brought forward. It's beautiful. And I was like, when I was doing the research, I was just up to my eyeballs. I was so over my head in Jewish writing, I can't even tell you. But fortunately, I was at a school where I had Jewish scholars. So I could like, am I understanding this right? Am I understanding this right? Mm-hmm. You know? And then like, why didn't we bring this stuff forward? It's beautiful. But as I'm doing all of that, I'm also starting to work on a model. Like what can we do as clinicians in just in supporting people to help them heal some of this shame? And so I developed a model called Healing the Mess, the model for erasing sexual shame. There are four parts. I call them frame, name, claim, and aim. So frame is get yourself a frame or a scaffolding of sex education. There's lots of good books out there. Understand the developing child, how you developed, what do you think you got at each of those places? If it wasn't what you wanted or needed, go read some of those kid books. And in my second book, I break it down birth to two, two to four, four to six, all the way to 18. And I like say, here are the top books for kids, for adults. Mm. And you can go to the library and get them and kind of take yourself through it. And then
like appropriately developmental things along the way.
Yeah. And love up on yourself, really, because, you know, most people were much more, and I love Ellen Nagoski talks about, you're so much more normal and common than you realize.
Yeah.
You know, you're good. You're really good. So get yourself that scaffolding of sex education. And I'm always happy to give recommendations on books. And I think I have a bunch of them on my Instagram as well. So that's frame. Name is tell your story to some compassionate or empathic other, right? Yeah. And that person is going to hold you with love. They're going to affirm the common things. They're going to give you little education here and there, or even just get a group of friends where you're all trying to figure this out yourself and like do a book group and read my book or, you know, whatever, but talk about it. Say, this is how it was for me. I didn't get what I needed. And I think it hurt me in this way. And you're going to find there's so much love and acceptance. And it's so common. You know, I often say,
well, and telling your story, right? It's like, that makes it takes all that like terrible thing that you thought they'd feel and react out of it. Right. It's like, it actually, nothing bad happened. Yeah.
No, nothing bad happens. And
when you told your story,
you're not alone. And that makes such a difference. Right. So that's the name part. Claim is claim your body is good, right? Mm-hmm. We have a diet industry that has us believing, many people believing, it's so easy, right? Metabolism is nothing. Just change what goes in, you know, and if you bought your and exercise more and you're going to lose weight. Well, actually, your heredity determines your body shape more than anything else. What's your history? Where do you come from? Who are your people? You know, I'm Swedish, you know, and I am built like my relatives. You know, I'm a Swede through and through. A lot of that. And there's a really good podcast that is called Maintenance Phase that dispels all the different myths that have been going on that we've been running a whole industry on, again, to get you to buy more things and do more things and feel worse about yourself, you know, but your body is good. If you are getting up in the morning and you are not in horrible pain and you are able to hug, love, listen, sit, walk, look at this outside, engage your senses. It is a good body. And I personally don't want anybody on their deathbed realizing that they spent the bulk of their life thinking that they weren't good enough because they somehow weren't built like somebody whose history allows them to be 6 foot and a size two or 120 pounds or 130 pounds or 40 pounds. I mean, we have eating disorders growing in men as well as women. Right.
Yeah.
And so, but your body is so good. It is the mechanism, the pen with which you write the poetry of your life. And
I do think the claiming part is so critical in this journey,
yes.
Because if you haven't claimed yourself, then
yeah,
you're looking outward and you're never really going to be able to be receptive to connection and real pleasure.
Right. And often you're going to put a mask on, right? You're going to put a mask of something yeah. on, and then you're going to think if someone loves me, they're loving the mask. They're not loving.
Right.
They're not.
Right. If they really knew me,
right?
They wouldn't love me.
They yeah. wouldn't love me because that's what shame tells them. You're not good enough. Right. And so then we have a hard time both giving love and believing it's authentic and receiving love and believing it's authentic. This is affecting people's core happiness, core contentment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so prevalent in our culture because we value product over people. And so therefore we do whatever we want so that our stockholders have more money at the end of the quarter. And we don't look at the effect on our populace. It's getting worse and has been getting worse for the last almost 50 years now. And it's not like we had it going great, but perfect before that by any stretch, right? But yeah, really changed. We changed our ethics and values as a culture.
Okay, so claim, and what's the fourth one?
The fourth one is aim. So as
yeah, okay.
you do these things, it's almost like unrolling a ball of yarn or whatever. As you're naming, as you're getting your education, as you're learning to say, this is a good body. I know it's got this and I know it's got this, but this is a good body. And you're working on that. As you're doing that, what you're going to find you're going to do is you're going to aim or create a whole new legacy. So now your relationship to yourself around your body and sexuality starts to improve. Your relationship to others and their bodies and sexuality begins to improve. Your understanding about the difference between truth and fantasy, what's real and what's not, begins to improve. And so you have voice about that in the world. And it's kind of like what you're saying. These women often in their 50s, they've been doing some of this often a little bit along the way. And now they can say, that's not... I don't enjoy that. That's not pleasurable for me. In fact, I think I've been doing things I didn't want to do for so long. I'm actually angry. I don't know who all I'm angry at, but I think I'm angry at you. I think I'm angry at culture. I think I'm angry at myself because I didn't know
yes,
better.
Yes, all of the above.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is this reclamation, but it's unfortunately not in a relational way. A lot of times it's just sort of a shutdown, sort of retraction, and
right.
the kids are off. And so now I can focus on me and what do I want, but healing the shame. And, I don't know, like a couple of months ago, I was reading, Sex for One, and I was just, reminded of like, it's so delightful, like how that whole process of self pleasure and celebration of self. And, it's the opposite of shame. It's the opposite of, all this hesitation and self-doubt.
Yeah.
And it's been there. Just we go through cycles.
Right. I had a client once who was newly widowed and had two small boys. And about 2 or 3 years after her husband had died, she said, I just am not yet ready to get out there, even though I'm recognizing that I'm awakening on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was kind of asking my permission, which I thought was really cute too. But she's like, I'm spending evenings after my kids are asleep and I have a small glass of wine and I sit in the hot tub and I masturbate and I remind myself that I'm a woman and that I'm whole and that my time to love will come again, but it's just not now. Just like, do you think that's okay? And I said, that to me sounds like a sacred ritual, like a type of a prayer that you are offering to the universe. Like, thank you that I am still alive and well, and my time will come. I said, it's one of the most beautiful things I've heard, you know?
Yeah.
And, but she didn't know that yet because she didn't grow up in a culture that taught her that, right? That taught her those things. One of the things I found when I was doing my research is that there's a group of guidelines that are taught still in boys' Jewish schools called the Vow of Ona. There's about 8 of them. You could do sex education through it because it's all because consent and power and all sorts of important things are in there. You could run your relationship by it, your dating relationship, your long-term relationship by it. It's so solid in how we treat each other, right? But one of the things that's in there that is often surprising to people is it says sex is considered a woman's right, not a man's. The husband has a duty, the ona, the vow of ona, to ensure that all forms of sexual touch are pleasurable to her. He is to study her.
Ooh.
Now, and a lot of people go, whoa, that is so countercultural. That is so counterintuitive yes. to what we've been taught. And I'm like, I know. And there is inside wisdom in here that is so mind-blowingly awesome that I just need to sometimes point it out because people can't see it right away. Imagine raising boys to say, you're going to have a sense of your own power. They're going to have things that are going to be feel really like, you know, you, but your growing edge is to learn others. And so we're going to practice that in this family. How's your sister different than you? How's your friend different than you? How do you know when they're upset, but they don't say so? And you teach them the fine skills of studying other people. With little girls, you do something different. You say, you're going to have and get encouragement to pay attention to others, right? But what you need to know is you. How are you being treated? How do you like being treated? How do you like being talked to? What's fun for you? What's comforting for you? You know, your body.
Right, because women are already taught to be so other oriented
yes,
and to be
exactly.
so caretaking. So to actually turn that energy towards self and to recognize like, what do I want? What works for me?
And then helping them have words for it and language for it, how to say it in a way that's clear, decisive, not passive, right? But also not
apologetic
mean and not apologetic, right? Clear, decisive, still kind, but clear, right? You teach them to do that the way along as they're growing.
So often in sex therapy, I mean, the first conversation is not, tell him what you like. It's, do you even know what you like?
That's right.
Right. It's self,
That's
it's self information, self discovery before they can share that with a partner, ask for it, you know, with clarity and confidence.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. So imagine now we have boys that we're raising who've been learning to study other and why that's important and how that's important to the relationship, right? Now we have girls that are clearer about themselves and why they're important. Like, yeah, I'm a goddess. I deserve to be treated well. I'm a, you know, they've got some sense of this, right? Now, when they're partnering in their 30s or late 20s or 30s or whatever, now they're partnering in a more egalitarian, mutual relationship that allows them to co-create a life, experiences, sexuality that's pleasurable to both of them. Right. And it's a life that's richer. It's just so much richer. All we're doing is that's what's so brilliant about this thousands year old idea is that it helps us grow our growing edge sooner rather than waiting till midlife where women are getting voice for the first time or midlife where men are realizing all of their career gains or whatever isn't what made them happy. It's their relationships and they're working on their second family. Because their first set of kids are like, you're never around, dude, not interested, right?
Yeah.
So this is what's kind of was to me, it was so fun to find this, but also it really highlights what we do incorrectly is for the human condition in the way that we raise our kids and run our society here in America.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like if we had more of these fundamental like skill building things from an early age, it would make such a difference in, you know, in longer term relationships, because I find that a lot of times these couples have mutual respect They have long-standing knowledge and history together, but their erotic life has been pretty dismal because they don't have the awareness, the skills, the trust, the confidence to do this work.
You know what else I think they don't have that we run retreats. The Northwest Institute on Intimacy runs retreats for couples, for straight couples, because these are the ones that we're often finding are just struggling so much. They also don't have a vision for what they could have. They don't have a vision for it because what they've been getting has been getting from media. And so, like, we have passion. We teach them all kinds of things about what culture has been teaching, so they have some ideas and clarity around things. But in the afternoon, they do a passion practice, and intercourse and penetration is off the table. In fact, doing things at the same time is off the table. So he's taught how to touch a woman, and she's taught how to receive and understand how scared he is, right? But just to receive his love. And that is so revolutionary that the next day when we flip it, it's also revolutionary, but in a different way. Because often for her, she's never had it all focused on her without anything being asked for from him at all. That's often sometimes the first time in their marriage that that's happened. And he is so blown away by how she receives, and since he can see her pleasure and he can see her open heart and her tears often, you know? And he's like, if I had any idea sex could look like that, porn would have never held a candle for me. And then the next day, when it's all about him, he's a little uncomfortable often because she's so honestly there. And she starts at his feet and his hand.
So instead, I love that too, taking, penetrative sex off the table, because that's always the go-to, often, not always, but often the
Often,
go-to. And that's often not very pleasurable for female partners.
right, exactly, and not the way that men know how to do it, even. And even if we flip, sometimes I play around and flip the script and say to a man, let's imagine you grew up in a culture and you were told, don't do any penetration in your anus at all, that's totally off bounds. But when you get married, she's going to want to do that every day or often, and really it's your job to let her penetrate you. Do you think there ever might be a day that you're like, yeah, I want to try something different? And they're usually looking at me like I'm crazy, right? And I'm like, you have to understand to be penetrated is different than to penetrate.
Yes, it
You know,
is.
back when pederasty was legal, the ones with the power penetrated the student follower. Right? It was a power. It was about power. And so we have to often help men understand women's experience because they don't know that she might at 9 was the first time that somebody whistled at her and she realized the world wasn't safe. That there were people bigger than her that could do something to her. Like they a lot of boys
Well,
stopped
and just
talking to her.
in inherently being in that receiving, position is just different. It is, there is a vulnerability, there
That's
is a
right.
sensitivity, there is a submission,
And I think these are things again that we could so easily talk about. We could talk about this in high school. We wouldn't be talking about it much earlier than that, but we could be talking about, so what would be different here, you know?
It depends on what state you live in, by the way. We could talk about that at any point, but
Well, I'm saying figuratively, we could. I mean, developmentally, a high school kid is already seeped in all that stuff. So to talk to them
definitely.
about it would be developmentally appropriate. That's what I mean. Yeah. There's a lot of places. There are only 18 states in the United States that have passed laws that require whatever sex education they have to be medically accurate. 18 today. And that's only changed by 3 in the last decade. And we know what's happening in states. They are removing laws. Arizona tried to reinstate a law from the 1800s a few weeks ago. So we live in crazy town now.
So getting accurate information is one piece of this, and they're getting information from porn, but they're not, it's not accurate. Certainly, it's not real life experience.
No, it's fantasy. Like we our kids grow up and know, oh, if I watch Spider-Man, that's fantasy. I don't get to scale walls. Or teenager watches the movie Fast and Furious and says, that's fantasy, fun to watch, but I don't drive that way. I die, right? Mm-hmm. They grow up with that information, contrasted, the actual information from the fantasy. We fail to do that around relationship education, emotional education, sexual education, body education, the way that we interact as adults, as far as connection and pleasure goes, we don't give them that. And free porn is often exploitive. Mm-hmm. And so that's the primary educator for lots of people. And it makes for bad lovers. I mean, I'm often saying to people, you know, like, I know it has a place, that's fine. Understand though, that that's fantasy. And if you bring this into your relationship, you assume she wants her hair pulled, you might find she's gone the next day. You're ghosted. It makes you a bad lover to a sensitive woman who wants to be able to say, wants you to ask, hey, what do you like?
Yeah.
She wants you to inquire.
Well, and I've also seen statistics of sex advancing, especially for female partners, beyond their comfort level at a pretty young age because they're watching porn and they're assuming that that's normal, even though it's not comfortable. It's certainly not pleasurable.
It can be very traumatizing.
Yeah.
The amount of cases that I supervise now where there's sexual trauma feels to me higher than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. And of course, what you're feeding your mind, regardless of, you know, what genre we're talking about, but if you're feeding your mind anything, that's more what your mind is thinking about. So porn is no different, right? You're watching porn. It's going to inform how you think, consciously or unconsciously, this is how it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And if I've got the education and I'm watching a bunch of, like, couldn't even tell you the names of some of these like shows that got so popular and had so many seasons and they were like warriors and, you know, mm-hmm. like whatever, you know, like I might watch all that and there's rape happening there. There's all kinds of things happening there. It was the chiefdom era, right? But mm-hmm. I don't live my life that way. I might think about, oh yeah, I watched that last night, but it doesn't shape how I interact with people at the office or how I interact with my partner because I've got the education behind it. We have porn probably around the globe, but in Northern European countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, Holland, they have comprehensive sex education that begins in kindergarten and runs through the senior year. People don't have the same, porn isn't as popular and they know the difference. We don't have as many reports of people of like abuse or teenage pregnancy or STI rates or any of the things, you know, because people know the difference.
Okay, so I'm going to do a bit of a pivot because I did notice that you're involved with psychedelics and that is really on the rise. It's, you know, I feel like it's coming more and more into the office. People are asking about it.
Yeah.
So what is your experience and how does that help sort of with healing?
Yeah, good question. So I did training in ketamine, psilocybin, and MDMA. MDMA is in front of the FDA right now. It's likely to get approval maybe as soon as August of this year. Then, of course, they're going to have to figure out all of the administration issues and that kind of thing. What we know from the research that's been coming through with MDMA's focus, so research is very narrow often. I mean, if you know anything about research, they don't go wide, they go narrow. So in with MDMA, what we looked at was post-traumatic stress disorder, primarily in vets, okay? Vets, that's a bipartisan issue. Veterans are a bipartisan issue. About 35% of PTSD is war PTSD. The rest is sexual PTSD. But what we found, and PTSD for therapists who know this, it can be very hard to treat it, to sort of get it to remit enough to give some freedom to that person's life. So there's a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, a lot of suicidal ideation, and just like a life that is shrouded in a dark cloud, right? What they found with, they did preparatory, the clinical trial was they did a preparation session. They did a medicine session, which is about 6 hours. Then they did an integration session or two, can't remember now, where they worked with what came up while they were under MDMA. Then they did another medicine, more integration sessions, another medicine, more integration sessions. So about 3 medicine sessions and about 12 to 15 sessions overall. And people have been, their PTSD assessment scores have been zero, like 68% of them up to a year later, because that's about right. So it is literally lifting people out of PTSD. We're seeing similar kinds of things with eating disorders, substance use, as well as trauma with psilocybin. And we're seeing relief of suicidal ideation, depression, and anxiety a lot of with ketamine. Now, ketamine doesn't stick as long as MDMA does. What the fMRI machines are showing is that after we hit adolescence or so, our brains start to think in patterns. Like we look at something, we go car, we go da da da. It thinks in patterns. Can also think in hurtful patterns, like I'm no good, I'm ugly, I'm this, I'm that, and we ruminate. It goes over and over and over, right? What psychedelics tend to do is allow the brain to go the way it was when you were little, like 5, and you thought something totally unique. It just goes to unique places, and you come out with these understandings like, oh, my mom was really wounded, and that's why she couldn't do that. And I don't just know that cognitively, I feel it in my body. And now
you don't have that automatic sort of automatic thought. Instead, you can make new connections, new meaning.
And it can stick, you know, and that's what's pretty remarkable about it. And why we have an opportunity, if we can help these medicines be administered in ethical, patient-centered, careful ways, with good follow-up, and make it available to everyone who needs it. We have a healthcare system that does not do that. But if we can find ways to do that, we could free so many people from so much pain and hardship that's affecting their lives. So that's why I got involved. Not to do it. I'm supporting physicians and therapists who are trained to do it and helping them create a container where they can be well cared for and protected and supported and trained, so then they can go forward and do it in a way that is mindful of all the indigenous communities that cared for the land for so long, makes scholarship funds so we make this available for people. So yeah, we're just trying to do it well.
That's great. Yeah, I'm definitely tracking that. And it's coming up more and more. So I'm hopeful, you know, if it's another avenue for healing, that get access to that.
It's the training is really worthwhile, I think.
I just started a training process and I'm, you know, it's more educational on that side of it to see sort of it's for ketamine specifically, because that's what's legal here. But
wonderful.
Okay, so just kind of winding down, what's coming up for you? I know you mentioned you have a retreat, and that's something that listeners could possibly get in on.
That's right. So if you go to nwioi.com and go to retreats, you'll learn about the retreat. That's the Northwest Institute on Intimacy. They run retreats once or twice a year for couples. They have one in October. I think there's only 2 or 3 spots left for that retreat. This, we've done over 200 couples over the last decade, and we have like an 85% success rate. Like people hold on to their learning and they build it into their life, and they make for a different marriage because they learn. We dispel so many myths, give them so much education, and then give them experiences with, you know, anywhere from 5 to 8 other couples who are also working just as hard to do this. And
I found that sometimes heterosexual couples, the men are a little hesitant, but they're willing to do it get vulnerable and talk openly.
Well, we've got different kinds of, like, we've got some men that are like, I've been so into my marriage and so into making it good. And from the get-go. Right. But then we have other men that are like, my wife really, really wants to do this. And I feel like if I don't come along and
Right.
open up to this,
Dragging her.
we're not doing good. We are not
Yeah.
doing good. And I'm up, I do want our marriage. And that's just it. We interview everybody separately on the phone before they come. They have to really want their marriage. They can be having really rough times, but they've got to want their marriage. No ongoing affair, no abuse, no unhealed or dealt with to some degree trauma. And they are all in. And so we're like,
Cool.
give it
Yeah.
your best
So
and build
they're kind of
soft.
primed and ready to do more of the positive stuff and really build. Well, that's
That's
great. That's
right.
a great resource. Well,
Yeah.
thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I feel like we could go a million directions. You're
We could. Yeah,
full of
thank you,
information,
Jen.
so
Yeah,
appreciate it.
super fun. Thank you. It was really fun.